This is a Reconstructionist radio production with lrnteach.com. Please visit kuiper.org/books to download or purchase this book. Christianity and Law, The Influence of Christianity on the Development of English Common Law, 2nd edition, 2010. Kuiper Foundation, Taunton, England. Narrated by Nathan F. Conkey. Preface to the second edition. The following essay on the influence of Christianity on the development of English common law was originally presented as a paper in the early 1990s at a national conference of Christian organisations concerned about maintaining the relevance and influence of the Christian faith and Christian moral standards in modern British society. It was subsequently published as a monograph by Avant Books in 1993. In the 19 years since it was originally published, the deterioration of the nation's legal and political institutions and the decline of the moral life of the people has continued to such an extent that we now find ourselves in a situation that can only be described as nothing short of a national apostasy. The declension of the nation from the Christian faith, which was observable throughout most of the 20th century, has become exponential at the beginning of the 21st century. On the 28th of February 2001, two High Court judges, Lord Justice Munby and Mr. Justice Beeston, delivered a judgment in which they made the following claim: "We cannot avoid the need to restate what ought to be, but seemingly are not, well understood principles regulating the relationship of religion and law in our society. We live in this country in a democratic and pluralistic society, in a secular state, not a theocracy. Although historically this country is part of the Christian West, and although it has an established church which is Christian, there have been enormous changes in the social and religious life of our country over the last century. Our society is now pluralistic and largely secular, but one aspect of its pluralism is that we also now live in a multicultural community of many faiths. One of the paradoxes of our lives is that we live in a society which has, at one and the same time, become both increasingly secular, but also increasingly diverse in its religious affiliation. We sit as secular judges, serving a multicultural community of many faiths. We are sworn," we quote the judicial oath, "to do right to all manner of people after the laws and usages of this realm, without fear or favour, affection or ill will. But the laws and usages of the realm do not include Christianity in whatever form. The aphorism that Christianity is part of the common law of England is mere rhetoric." These words demonstrate clearly enough the degree to which our legal institutions are being secularised by contemporary judges, but they reveal also a formidable ignorance regarding the nature of English law generally. Is it really the case that the laws and usages of the realm do not include Christianity in whatever form? By no means. The law of the Church of England is still part of the law of the land. The Church of England as a whole and each of its component institutions are subject to a variety of laws, rules and norms, some imposed by the state, some made by the Church with the concurrence of the state, and others created internally by the Church itself at national, provincial and diocesan level. The laws applicable to the Church of England are to be found in Acts of Parliament, in measures and canons, in a variety of rules and regulations, in the common law of England as revealed in the judgments of ecclesiastical and temporal courts, in custom, and in divine or natural law. The law of the Church of England is part of the law of the land. As Uthwart Jay stated in Attorney General versus Dean and Chapter of Ripon Cathedral, the law is one, but jurisdiction as to its enforcement is divided between the ecclesiastical courts and the temporal courts. Regarding English law more generally, we must remember that as late as 1953, Queen Elizabeth II, as part of her coronation oath, swore to maintain the laws of God and the true profession of the gospel, and the Protestant Reformed religion established by law. Constitutionally, nothing has changed since then with regard to the position occupied by the Church of England in particular, and the Christian religion established by law more generally. Perhaps if the learned judges had quoted more of the judicial oath to which they refer, and incorrectly understand as binding them to the principles of secularism, the inconsistency, indeed the absurdity of their views, and the delinquency of their judgment, would have been immediately apparent. The judicial oath requires those who take it to say the following: I do swear by Almighty God that I will well and truly serve our sovereign, Lady Queen Elizabeth II, in the office of, and I will do right to all manner of people after the laws and usages of this realm, without fear or favour, affection or ill will. Lord Justice Munby and Mr. Justice Beeston have sworn, by Almighty God, to serve Queen Elizabeth II as a Christian Queen, who herself has sworn to maintain the laws of God, the true profession of the Gospel, and the Protestant Reformed religion established by law. In what sense, therefore, does the judicial oath require them to enshrine the principles of secularism in their judgments? In no sense. What it requires them to do is administer the law of the land impartially as servants of Queen Elizabeth II. The secular principles to which the judges claim to adhere are religious principles that run counter to the religious principles upon which the law of the land is ultimately based, and in championing such principles in their judgments, they are failing in their duty to serve Queen Elizabeth II in accordance with the oath they have sworn by Almighty God. It is true, of course, that modern Britain has embraced secularism and multiculturalism, and there is a growing institutionalised antipathy to the Christian religion, evidence of which can be seen, for example, in perverse judgments of the modern judiciary, such as the one referred to above. But what this reveals is not that modern Britain is no longer a Christian nation. Rather, it reveals that modern Britain is an apostate nation. It is the purpose of this monograph to demonstrate that the aphorism, "Christianity is part of the common law of England," is by no means mere rhetoric, but indeed profoundly true. National apostasy does not alter our history, nor in itself does it alter the Constitution, no matter how much our judges may like to think that it does. The answer to this apostasy, therefore, is not the secularisation of our laws, but national repentance and a return to the Christian principles of justice that underpinned our law and guided the nation for so long. The text is substantially the same as that published in 1993. I have added very little other than to make minor alterations to grammar and correct a few typographical errors. Stephen C. Perks, September 2012. Christianity and Law. The Influence of Christianity on the Development of English Common Law. Summary. For the purpose of this essay, Arthur Hoag's definition of common law as the body of rules prescribing social conduct and justiciable in the Royal Courts of England has been adopted. This definition does not include the Courts of Equity, however. English common law evolved out of the practice of the Royal Courts, which administered a body of rules common to the whole realm in the period following the Norman Conquest. Its sources, however, go back to the pre-Norman laws and customs of England. With the arrival of Augustine's mission in 597 and the subsequent conversion of Ethelbert to the Christian faith, England came under the influence of the Christian religion, and the laws of the Anglo-Saxon kings reveal increasingly throughout the second half of the first millennium the strong influence of biblical ideals and law. This is particularly noticeable with Alfred and his successors, who held up the Mosaic law as the ideal that the nation must follow if it is to be blessed by God. Heathen practices were forbidden, and those who continued in them were commanded to cease or leave the country with their possessions and their sins. The church was protected by law, granted immunity from taxation, and the clergy became important members of the king's witan, council. Church and royal law were not separated, and the king ruled as head of state and church, making laws for both. As a result, Germanic practices and norms were modified under the influence of Christianity, and many elements of social life and judicial procedure incompatible with Christianity became obsolete. The Anglo-Saxon understanding of moral responsibility and legal liability acquired a Christian meaning. After the Norman conquest, many of the pre-Norman dooms and customs of Anglo-Saxon England remained in force, but were modified and transformed to meet the contemporary situation. The Normans provided a strong central government, and as the administration of justice in royal courts by royal justices increased, the old courts of shire and hundred and the feudal courts declined in importance. The new situation created by the Norman presence, along with the ascendancy of the royal courts, drawing on pre-Norman laws and customs, led to the creation of the common law. Church and lay jurisdictions were separated, however, but the church continued to exercise a strong influence on the lay courts in an indirect manner. After the Papal Revolution, late 11th and early 12th centuries, the canonists developed an integrated and complex system of canon law applicable in the ecclesiastical courts. This was the first modern Western legal system. The secular state imitated this in many important ways, adopting aspects of both the legal theory and procedure of canon law. English common law, however, did not come under the controlling influence of Roman law. The theology of Western Christendom played an important part in shaping legal theory in the West generally. The Western theory of retributive justice was a result of developments in theology following the Papal Revolution, particularly Anselm's theory of the atonement. Modern theories of legal representation, taking of oaths before giving testimony, the emphasis on judicial investigation and rules for determining the relevance of evidence were all developed and practiced first in the ecclesiastical courts and later adopted by the lay courts. The influence of Christianity mitigated many pagan and barbaric elements of pre-Christian judicial procedure, such as the ordeal, modifying them according to biblical principles, and eventually leading to their abandonment. Furthermore, in the first half of the second millennium, morality and law were not so sharply distinguished, and human law was subject to the requirement that it should conform to reason and the law of God, which were then considered to be practically the same thing. This remained the case even after case law and precedent came to dominate the common law system. In equity also, the common rule was that no law is just or binding if it contravenes reason or the law of God. The common law system was developed during the 12th and 13th centuries by the royal judges, who were mostly ecclesiastics. The law and customs of England, which were themselves strongly influenced by Christianity during the second half of the first millennium, were transformed into the common law system during the first half of the second millennium by Christian judges, under the influence of the church and Christian ideals. The church also provided in many respects a model of government for the secular state. The English legal system was formed and developed over centuries under the dominating influence of the Christian religion. Our system of justice is what it is, and distinguishable from other far less civilized systems, because of the influence and input that the Christian religion has brought to it. Now, however, the Christian presuppositions upon which the law was built, and upon which it relied for its validity and authority, are being abandoned by the people, and by their legislators and judges. And as a result, the traditional understanding of the rule of law, which guided the nation for so long, is being overturned in favour of the rule of politicians, who legislate in terms of pragmatic principles rather than Christian ideals. Our legislators no longer recognise the authority of a higher law to which all human law must conform if it is to be valid. Consequently, Christian law is being replaced by law based on religious and philosophical presuppositions that are alien to our legal traditions. For over 1,000 years, the Christian faith influenced and helped to shape English law, and the law underpinned the nation's Christian heritage. Both are now in ruins. The remedy for this malady lies in recognising once more that all human law must conform to the standards of justice revealed in God's law, definition of common law. The term common law can have a number of different meanings, depending on its context. In a very broad sense, the term can mean the legal system and habits of legal thought that Englishmen have evolved. In this sense, it is contrasted with systems of law derived from Roman law. In a narrower sense, it refers to those laws that are common to the whole of the kingdom and derived from common usage and custom. In this sense, it contrasts with whatever is particular, extraordinary, and special, whether that distinctiveness is due to geographical, political, or other factors. For example, common law is not local law or custom, nor is it mercantile or canon, that is, ecclesiastical law, though the term is derived from the usage of the canonists. Common law derives largely from ancient usage and precedent, though it is anachronistic to apply the term to any period earlier than the 13th century. Common law contrasts with statute law and often means that part of English law, including equity, which is unenacted, especially that contained in the decisions of the courts as opposed to acts of parliament and subordinate legislation. Although generally common law is in origin customary law, it does, however, comprehend some principles that did not originate in legislation. On the other hand, common law is contrasted with equity, which was administered in the Court of Chancery. Equity is applied where common law and the precedents established under it are not able to provide a framework for justice in particular or special circumstances. It is clear from this that a simple, trouble-free definition of common law is not easy. Writing of the 12th and 13th centuries, Arthur Hoge defines common law in a broad sense as the body of rules prescribing social conduct and justiciable in the royal courts of England. For our purposes, we shall use this definition of common law since our concern is not with a more narrow or particular definition and understanding of common law, but rather with the influence of Christianity and biblical principles of justice upon the development of English law. This definition does not embrace the Court of Chancery, which was the principal court of equity, or Star Chamber. The origin of common law. The dating of the development of common law usually begins with the Norman Conquest. Over the 2 centuries that followed 1066, the Norman and Angevin kings slowly established a system of royal courts that administered justice across the whole realm, according to a common body of laws. Prior to this development, the principal courts in existence were the communal courts of shire and hundred and the feudal courts of the landowners. However, the sources of English common law go back to pre-Norman times and were embodied in local customs, which at many points differed between the kingdoms of Wessex, Mercia and Danelaw, and the dooms of the English kings going back to Alfred. As a result of the Norman conquest and the establishment of royal courts throughout the kingdom over the following centuries, these local customs were unified under one system of law common to all men, later called the Common Law. The jurisdiction of the shire, hundred and feudal courts was not abolished formally, but rather declined as the jurisdiction of the royal courts increased. Before looking at the emergence of the common law during this period, we shall look at the influence of Christianity and biblical law on English law prior to the Norman conquest. English law in the Anglo-Saxon period. The Kingdom of England, being a very ancient kingdom, wrote Sir Matthew Hale in his History of the Common Law, has had many vicissitudes and changes, especially before the coming of King William I, under several either conquests or accessions or foreign nations. For thou, the Britons were, as is supposed, the most ancient inhabitants, yet there were mingled with them, or brought in upon them, the Romans, Picts, Saxons, the Danes, and lastly, the Normans, and many of those foreigners were, as it were, incorporated together and made one common people and nation, and hence arises the difficulty, and indeed moral impossibility, of giving any satisfactory or so much as probable conjecture touching the origin of the laws. In spite of this difficulty, however, we do have some of the laws of the Saxon kings, beginning with Ethelbert, the first Christian king of England, and it is possible to trace the influence of the Christian faith upon the laws enacted by these kings as the centuries pass. Indeed, a careful study of the sources that we have demonstrates beyond doubt the truth of Hale's comment that the growth of Christianity in this kingdom and the reception of learned men from other parts, especially from Rome, and the credit that they obtained here might reasonably introduce some new laws and antiquate or abrogate some old ones that seemed less consistent with the Christian doctrines, and by this means not only some judicial laws of the Jews, but also some points relating to, or bordering upon, or derived from the canon or civil laws, as may be seen in those laws of the ancient kings, Ina, Alfred, Canutus, etc., collected by Mr. Lambert. Christianity came to Britain during the 1st century, brought here probably by Roman soldiers. With the fall of Rome and the exodus of the Roman legions, however, Britain was open to invasion by the heathen. Without Roman help and cut off from the rest of the Christian world, the British were pushed back into Wales and Cornwall by the invading Jutes, Saxons and Angles. England was settled by pagans who knew nothing of the Christian faith. In 597, however, Augustine landed in Kent with his Christian mission. Ethelbert, king of Kent, although a pagan, had married a Frankish Christian princess who kept her faith, and as a result, Augustine's mission was not opposed. Ethelbert was himself eventually baptized, and it is from his conversion that we can begin to trace the development of English common law. According to J.M. Wallace Handrill, when the Pope reminded Ethelbert of the example of Constantine and Queen Bertha, and that of Helena, as he also reminded other kings and queens, he meant it to be understood that the new convert was entering the family of Catholic kings of whom the emperor was the father. Papal and imperial correspondence of the period leaves no doubt about this. He assures Bertha that bona vestra, your virtues, have been reported not merely in Rome, but even in Constantinople, where they have reached the ears of the Serenissimum Principem, the emperor. Politically, this might mean little or nothing, but one certain consequence would be that the new convert would enter into the tradition of written law, of which the emperor was the fountainhead. Wallace Handrill goes on to explain that this is one reason why Ethelbert's laws must be dated after his conversion. Law books were a Roman, a specifically Christian Roman gift to the Germanic kings. Ethelbert's laws, the earliest document written in the English language, deals almost exclusively with monetary compensation payable to victims of crime or injury. The very first law deals with sacrilege. Theft of God's property and the church's shall be compensated 12-fold, a bishop's property 11-fold, a priest's property 9-fold, a deacon's property 6-fold, a clerk's property 3-fold. Breach of the peace shall be compensated doubly when it affects a church or a meeting place. The Pope, when he heard about the heavy compensation, insisted that simple restitution was all that was required. This was equally in error. For theft, the Bible demands restitution of between a fifth and fivefold. Leviticus 6:5, Exodus 22:1. Of interest in regard to this is the fact that Ethelbert himself only required ninefold restitution for theft of his property. Apart from this opening clause, there is nothing overtly Christian or biblical in the content of the law code. Perhaps the main failure, and this is a failure of all the Anglo-Saxon law codes, including Alfred's, was the readiness to substitute the payment of a man's wergild, or blood price, as compensation for murder rather than the death penalty. This may seem incredible to modern readers, but in the context of society as it then existed, it had an ameliorating effect by limiting blood feuds, which often had very destructive consequences. In that light, it is not so barbarous, and compared with the modern practice of putting a murderer into prison for a few years at the expense of the taxpayer, then setting him free without compensation for the victim's family, it must be seen as positively enlightened. Nevertheless, the Bible, although it requires compensation for most offences and permits the payment of a ransom in cases of accidental manslaughter, see Exodus 21:30 for instance, demands that no ransom be taken for the life of a murderer, and that he be put to death, Numbers 35:31. However, with the coming of Christianity and, as a result of that, written law codes, there is a new element in Anglo-Saxon lawmaking. What is new is that the king, by causing them to be written, makes them his own. Lawgiving is a royal function. It is something that the emperors, through the church, can give kings. It comes with Christianity. A royal book is made, to be stored, it may be, with the books of the Bible. Not inappropriately either, since the Bible too was a repository of laws. Of interest next are the law codes of Wictred, King of Kent, issued in 695, and of Ine, King of Wessex, issued between 688 and 694. Wictred's code begins with the recognition of an important principle. The church shall enjoy immunity from taxation. In return, the clergy are commanded to pray for the king and honour him. The king shall be paid for, and they shall honour him freely and without compulsion. Furthermore, the moonbeard of the church shall be 50 shillings, like the king's. Much of Wictred's code is concerned with the church and Christian practice. Wictred, like his West Saxon contemporary Ine, whose laws owe much to Kent, legislates with the church in the forefront of his mind. For example, regarding Christian marriage, we read, "Foreigners, if they do not regularize their unions, shall depart from the land with their possessions and with their sins." While, for the same offence, men of our country also shall be excluded from the communion of the church without being subject to forfeiture of their goods. Men living in illicit unions are also commanded to turn to a righteous life, repenting of their sins, or they shall be excluded from the communion of the church. There are also fines for both noblemen and commoners for entering illicit unions, 100 shillings and 50 shillings respectively. It seems that Sabbatarianism predates the usual era given for its emergence among the Puritans of the 17th century, since in Wictred's code there are laws governing work on Sundays, with fines for disobedience. Worship of devils is forbidden, with fines and forfeiture of possessions as punishment. Other laws deal with priests entering illicit unions or being too drunk to discharge their duties, the granting of the freedom on the altar, procedures and formulas for compurgation in cases involving the clergy, and for commoners accused of crimes related to the clergy, and sundry other laws relating to theft. The laws of Ine, King of Wessex, show a similar concern for the church and Christian observance. Ine declares in the prologue to his law code, "I, Ine, by the grace of God, King of Wessex, with the advice and instruction of Senred, my father, of Hede, my bishop, and of Erconwald, my bishop, and with all my ealdormen, and the chief counsellors of my people, and with a great concourse of the servants of God as well, have been taking counsel for the salvation of our souls and the security of our realm, in order that just laws and just decrees may be established and ensured throughout our nation, so that no ealdorman nor subject of ours may, from henceforth, pervert our decrees." This is the most overtly Christian prologue to an English law code before Alfred's. Interestingly, Ine's law code is only known as an appendix to the law code of Alfred. The earliest manuscript dates from about 925. Ine commands that a child shall be baptized within 30 days. If this is not done, the guardian shall pay 30 shillings compensation. If the child dies before baptism, however, The guardian forfeited all his possessions. There then follows a law governing work on Sunday. If a slave works on Sunday by his lord's command, he shall become free, and the lord shall pay a fine of 30 shillings. If a slave worked without his master's knowledge, he was punished with the lash or a fine in lieu of the lash. A free man who worked on Sunday, except by his lord's command, stood to lose his freedom or pay 60 shillings fine. However, a priest who offended was required to pay a double fine. Church dues were to be rendered at Martinmas, November the 11th. Those who failed in this were required to pay a fine of 60 shillings to the king and 12-fold compensation to the church. There are also laws governing the use of the church as a sanctuary by fugitives. Other laws cover compurgation, fines and compensation for crimes, and various other matters. It is in King Alfred, however, that we see most clearly the growing influence of Christianity upon English culture and law. H.R. Loyne writes of Christianity under Alfred's reign. The Christian religion provided the most potent binding force known to Western society in the 9th century, and this was particularly true when the ruler was as good a Christian as Alfred. In him, more than in any other rulers of the period, even the great Charles himself, we see the ideal of Christian kingship, a successful defender of Christian peoples against pagan onslaught, and also an assiduous supporter of scholarship and of Christian missionary effort. And, in order to make the basis of his authority better appreciated, he drew with great wisdom upon the work of Gregory, the Fortitude of Boethius, and the World Picture of Osirius, and the Theology of St. Augustine of Hippo, from whose works he had sound and workmanlike translations made at his West Saxon court. With Alfred, however, there is more than a concern for the church and Christian practice, but also a commitment to the specific contents of biblical law. Consequently, Alfred's law code begins with a long introduction which contains translations into English of the Ten Commandments, Exodus 20:1-7, the Law of Moses, the Book of the Covenant, Exodus 20:23-23:33, the Golden Rule, Matthew 7:12, along with an account of apostolic history, including translations from the Acts of the Apostles, and an account of the growth of church law as established by ecumenical and English church councils. According to Attenborough, this lengthy introduction has no bearing on Anglo-Saxon law. This is an astonishing statement. Certainly Alfred's introduction had a bearing on his law code. As Alfred says in the prologue to his code, "I, King Alfred, have collected these laws and have given orders for copies to be made of many of those which our predecessors observed and which I myself approved of. But many of those I did not approve of I have annulled by the advice of my counsellors, while, in other cases, I have ordered changes to be introduced. Those which were the most just of the laws I found, whether they dated from the time of Ine, my kinsman, or of Offa, king of the Mercians, or of Ethelbert, who was the first king to be baptised in England, these I have collected while rejecting the others." And what criterion should we expect King Alfred, who manifested the ideal of Christian kingship, to use in determining what was just and what should be annulled? Surely Christian principles would play a large part in King Alfred's conception of justice, and therefore affect his choice of which laws were to be retained from times past and which were to be annulled. Alfred says of the Golden Rule, Matthew 7:12, "From this one doom, a man may remember that he judge everyone righteously. He need no other doom book." Consequently, as Berman points out, Alfred's laws themselves, although largely consisting of a recapitulation of earlier collections, contain such striking provisions as, "Doom very evenly, doom not one doom to the rich, another to the poor, nor doom one to your friend, another to your foe." This is very clearly a restatement of Leviticus 19:15, which states, "You shall do no injustice in judgment, for you shall not be partial to the poor, nor defer to the great, but you are to judge your neighbour fairly." This is not to say that the laws of King Alfred collected and retained from previous Anglo-Saxon law codes were purged of all pagan elements. For example, we read, "If a slave rapes a slave, castration shall be required as compensation," which can hardly be squared with the Bible. But Alfred's Law Code generally exhibits a different spirit. Remarkably, F.M. Stinton, like Attenborough before him, considers Alfred's citation of the Law of Moses to have no bearing on his Law Code, and claims that it was no more than an attempt to acquaint his subjects with what he regarded as a model piece of legislation. There is no trace of any extraneous elements in the text of his own law, which are, indeed, remarkably conservative. Stinton writes, "But, on the other hand," Stinton then admits, "there are important features in his laws which are not derived from any known source and may be original." Stinton knows of no possible source for these new elements in Alfred's code, and therefore draws the conclusion that they may be original. Anyone familiar with the Bible will have no difficulty in recognising the features of which Stinton speaks. They include, writes Stinton, "provisions protecting the weaker members of society against oppression, limiting the ancient custom of blood feud, and emphasising the duty of man to his Lord." Given Alfred's commitment to the Christian religion, is it not reasonable, indeed necessary, to conclude that these new, enlightened elements in his code were the result of the influence of Christianity and biblical law upon Alfred's own thinking? As Wallace Handrell says, "to assemble the folk law and reissue them as their own had seemed an enhancement of kingship to the Carolingians. It was a legislative function with political overtones." Alfred, however, did more than this. To revise and reissue his predecessor's laws as his own was nothing new, but his remarkable prologue suggests something more. Stinton is nearer the mark when he adds, "A religious king, whose own life had once depended on the loyalty of his men, might be expected to legislate in this spirit, and these provisions may be added to the evidence of Alfred's character, which is supplied in his writings." What is the reason for this myopia when it comes to understanding the influence of Christianity on Western culture? Attenborough's and Stinton's failure to identify the influence of biblical law upon Alfred's code bears out R.J. Rushdoony's comment that a very real defect of scholars has been their ignorance of biblical law. As a result, much has been called pagan, which was, in reality, biblical. Certainly, Alfred's translation of the laws of Moses was meant to acquaint his subjects with a model piece of legislation, as Stinton argues, but, as Wallace Handrell, referring to Stinton's argument, points out, it implies another, to link to his own legislation with that of the Bible, and, by linking it, to accept the Bible as valid moral law. With modifications, he accepts the Mosaic law of Exodus as current, and, by an excerpt from St. Matthew, he demonstrates that Christ had also accepted it as current and valid. "The righteous man," says Alfred, "needs no other law book. The ethic of the Decalogue was an acceptable basis for all law." But men were not righteous. They did need another law, and Alfred shows how, since the critical event of the baptism of Ethelbert, such law has been provided for the English people. He in turn does what he can. The collection of laws that he makes for them is what he would probably have called Christian law. Alfred's law code contains many of the laws of his predecessors, with some modifications. Much of the code is concerned with compensation to victims for injuries, either accidental or criminal in nature. Compensation is specified for the life of a slain man, his vergold, or blood price, which, though unbiblical in cases of murder, represented a considerable improvement on the blood feud that was likely to follow without it, and for this reason it was supported actively by the church. There are also laws concerning the protection of church property and respect for church law. Many of Alfred's laws are pagan in origin, it is true, setting forth penalties that are not consistent with biblical law. But the code generally is subject to a Christianizing influence, which, as we have seen, made Alfred's laws more just and concerned with issues and emphases that were derived from the Bible. Furthermore, Stinton observes that Alfred's Law Code has a significance in general history, which is entirely independent of its subject matter. In his preface, Alfred gives himself no higher title than King of the West Saxons, and he names his kinsman, Ine, first among the three kings whose work had influenced his own. But the names of Offa and Ethelbert, which follow in the list, imply that Alfred's code was intended to cover not only Wessex, but Kent and English Mercia. It thus becomes important evidence of the new political unity forced upon the various English peoples by the struggle against the Danes. Even without this adventitious interest, it would still be a landmark in English legal history. It appeared at the end of a century which no English king had issued laws. Everywhere in Western Europe, kings were ceasing to exercise the legislative powers which traditionally belonged to their office. In England alone, through Alfred's example, the tradition was maintained to be inherited by each of the two foreign kings who acquired the English throne in the 11th century. This is significant for our understanding of the influence that Christianity had on the development of English common law. The common law principles of justice that were applied in later centuries, as we have seen, had roots going back before the Norman conquest. These common law roots go back to the ancient customs and laws of the people of England, and it is in Alfred's Law Code that we first find law being made for all of Anglo-Saxon England. But Alfred left more than just laws for the Anglo-Saxons in England. In 878, Alfred defeated the Danish king, Guthrum. The terms of the surrender stipulated not only that Guthrum withdraw from Alfred's kingdom, but that he and his leading men be baptized also. In the laws agreed upon and enacted by Alfred and Guthrum, the commitment to love one God and zealously renounce all heathen practices stands first. The code goes on to state, if anyone offends against the Christian religion or honours heathen practices by word or deed, he shall pay either wergeld or fine or laslit, the fine incurred by a breach of the law, according to the nature of the offence. Failure to pay tithes is punished with fines. There are also Sabbatarian laws, as with Wictred, Ine and Alfred. For example, if anyone proceeds to bargain on a Sunday, he shall forfeit the goods and 12 oars and 30 shillings in an English district. This law code testifies to the Christian shadow that Alfred cast not only over Anglo-Saxon England, but also over those territories under the rule of the Danes. The following laws are the last in the code. I have added in square brackets references to biblical laws which deal with the same issues. 11. If wizards or sorcerers, Exodus 22:18, Leviticus 20:27, Deuteronomy 18:10-13, perjurers, Exodus 23:1, Deuteronomy 19:16-19, or they who secretly compass death, Exodus 21:12-14, Leviticus 24:17, or vile, polluted, notorious prostitutes, Leviticus 19:29, Deuteronomy 22:20-21, be met with anywhere in the country, they shall be driven from the land, and the nation shall be purified. Otherwise, they shall be utterly destroyed in the land, unless they cease from their wickedness and make amends to the utmost of their ability. 12. If any attempt is made to deprive in any wise a man in orders, or a stranger, of either his goods or his life, Exodus 22:21-24, Deuteronomy 24:17, the king, or the earl of the province in which such a deed is done, and the bishop of the diocese, shall act as his kinsmen and protectors, unless he has some other, Luke 10:30-37, and such compensation as is due shall be promptly paid to Christ, Deuteronomy 21:1-9, and the king, according to the nature of the offence, or the king within whose dominions the deed is done, shall avenge it to the uttermost. The laws and ordinances of Edward the Elder, circa 900-925, and of Æthelstan, circa 925-939, the first king to exercise direct rule over all England, including the Danes, similarly reflects the influence of Christianity. The first clause in I, Æthelstan reads, I, King Æthelstan, with the advice of Archbishop Wulfhelm, and my other bishops also, inform the reeve in every borough, and pray you in the name of God and of all his saints, and command you also by my friendship that, in the first place, ye render tithes of my own property, both in livestock and in yearly fruits of the earth, measuring, counting, and weighing them in accordance with the strictest accuracy. And the bishops shall do the same with their own property, and my aldermen, and my reeves likewise. He goes on to say, let us remember how Jacob the patriarch declared, Decimas et hostias, pacificas, offeram tibi. Tithes and animal sacrifices, peace offerings, I shall give to you. And how Moses declared in God's law, Decimas et primitas, non tardabis, offere domino. You shall not be slow to offer tithes and first fruits to the Lord. Furthermore, we are told that it behoves us to remember how terrible is the declaration stated in the books. If ye are not willing to render tithes to God, he will deprive us of the 9 remaining parts when we least expect it, and, moreover, we shall have sinned also. Another piece of legislation from Anglo-Saxon law codes of interest for our purposes is Æthelstan's ordinance relating to charities. I, King Æthelstan, with the advice of Wulfhelm, my archbishop, and of all my other bishops and ecclesiastics, for the forgiveness of my sins, make known to all my reeves within my kingdom that it is my wish that you shall always provide a destitute Englishman with food, if you have such an one in your district, or if you find one elsewhere. 1. From 2 of my rents he shall be supplied with an amber of meal, a shank of bacon, or a ram worth 4 pence every month, and clothes for 12 months annually. And I desire you to make free annually 1 man who has been reduced to penal slavery, and all this shall be done for the loving kindness of God, and for the love you bear me, with the cognizance of the bishop in whose diocese the gift is made. 2. And if the reeve neglects to do this, he shall pay 30 shillings compensation, and the money shall be divided, with the cognizance of the bishop, among the poor who are on the estate where this remains unfulfilled. During the century before the Norman conquest, the kings of England continued to issue law codes, and these codes evidence the continuing influence of Christianity and of the Church upon them. Of particular importance are the law codes of Cnut, which, along with other law codes going back to Alfred and Ine, were the main sources for determining English law after the Norman conquest, when the English common law system was beginning to take shape. Loyne, commenting on this period, states that in the legislative field, there is an indication of the development of relationships between growing state and church, strongly reminiscent of continental development during the Carolingian period. Indeed, owing to the strength and tenacity of the West Saxon monarchy in the 10th and 11th centuries, theocracy in England was even more fully extended and survived later. The writings of homilists in the late 10th and early 11th centuries bear out this conclusion. In later Anglo-Saxon England, ideas of Christian kingship and the sight of that kingship in action illustrate the closer interdependence of the church as an institution and the state. The law codes issued by the kings themselves also bear out the same conclusion. In 8 Ethelred 2.1, for instance, we read, "For a Christian king is Christ's deputy among the Christian people, and he must avenge with the utmost diligence offences against Christ." The growing influence of Christianity and of biblical law in Ethelred's law codes is very strong. 6 Ethelred 28.2 states, "Greed, gluttony, and intemperance, frauds and various breaches of the law, violations of marriage and of holy orders, breaches of festivals and of feasts, sacrilege, and misdeeds of many kinds." The list clearly shows the influence that the Bible was exerting upon Anglo-Saxon law codes at this time. The next clause but one states the matter succinctly. "God's law shall henceforth be zealously cherished in word and deed. Then God will forthwith be gracious towards this people." Significantly, along with this concern for the proper observance of God's law, there is a concern for the improvement of the coinage. Clause 32 reads, "Public security shall be promoted in such a way as shall be best for the householder and worst for the thief, number one, and the coinage shall be improved by having one currency, free from all adulteration, throughout all the country, number two, and weights and measures shall be corrected with all diligence, and an end put to all unjust practices. The concern for God's law and a sound, honest monetary system clearly go hand in hand, the latter being the natural result of a sincere desire to obey God's law. The biblical law on just weights and measures are given in Leviticus 19:35-37 and Deuteronomy 25:13-16. Many more citations from Ethelred's law codes could be given to demonstrate this concern for the upholding of God's law. There is simply not the space here to do justice to the point. In citing those laws that reflect directly the content of biblical law, it is difficult sometimes to know where to stop. The following are a good example. I have added in square brackets references to the biblical texts. 42. And likewise, we desire earnestly to exhort all our friends, as there is need for us to do frequently, to take thought diligently for themselves, and eagerly to turn from sins, and to restrain other men from wrongdoing, and frequently and often to have in mind what is of supreme importance for men to remember, namely, that they should have a right belief in the true God, who is the ruler and maker of all created things, and that they should duly keep the true Christian faith, diligently obey their spiritual teachers, and zealously follow the precepts and ordinances of God, and that they should diligently maintain the security and sanctity of the churches of God everywhere, and frequently visit them with candles and offerings, and themselves they are earnestly pray to God. 43. And that every year they should duly render their ecclesiastical dues. Leviticus 27:30, Numbers 18:24-28, Deuteronomy 14:22, and duly observe festivals and feasts. Deuteronomy 16:16. 44. And that they should diligently abstain from marketings and public assemblies on Sundays. Exodus 20:8-13. 45. And that they should always protect and honour the servants of God. 1 Timothy 5:17-19. 46. And that they should comfort and feed the poor. Exodus 23:11. Leviticus 19:9-10. 25:35. Deuteronomy 24:14-15. 47. And that they should not be constantly oppressing the widow and the orphan, but that they should diligently cheer them. Exodus 22:22-24, Deuteronomy 10:18-19, 14:28-29, 16:11, 14, 26:12, 27:19, 48, that they should not vex or oppress strangers and men come from afar. Exodus 22:21, 23:3, 6, Leviticus 19:33-34, Deuteronomy 10:18-19, 14:28-29, 16:11, 14, 26:12, 27:19, 49, and that they should not excel in offering injustice to other men, but that every man should, to the best of his ability, show the justice to others that he desires should be shown to him, which is a very just rule. Exodus 23:2-6, Leviticus 19:15, Deuteronomy 1:17, 16:18-20, Matthew 7:12, compare 7:2. 50. And he who henceforth anywhere violates the just decrees of God or of men shall render full compensation in whatever way is fitting, whether by making the amends required by ecclesiastical authority or by paying the penalty demanded by the secular law. Exodus 22:1-15, etc. One last citation from the laws of Ethelred will sum the whole matter up. And constant thought shall be taken in every way how best to determine what is advisable for the public good, and how best to promote true Christianity, and to suppress with all diligence every injustice. Number 1. For it is only by the suppression of injustice and the love of righteousness in matters both religious and secular that any improvement shall be obtained in the condition of the country. The laws of King Knut, which largely reenact the laws of Edgar and Ethelred, but which are more comprehensive, drawing material from homilies and penitentials as well as older laws, show the same concern for the law of God and the upholding of the Christian religion. In 2 Knut we read, "This is further the secular ordinance, which, By the advice of my counsellors, I desire should be observed over all England. 1. The provision is that I desire that justice be promoted and every injustice zealously suppressed, that every illegality be rooted up and eradicated from this land with the utmost diligence, and the law of God promoted. 1. And henceforth all men, both poor and rich, shall be regarded as entitled to the benefit of the law, and just decisions shall be pronounced on their behalf. 2. And we enjoin that, even if anyone sins and commits grievous crime, the punishment shall be ordered as shall be justifiable in the sight of God, and acceptable in the eyes of men. 2a. And he who has authority to give judgment shall consider very earnestly what he himself desires when he says thus, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive them that trespass against us. 1. And we forbid the practice of condemning Christian people to death for very trivial offences. On the contrary, merciful punishment shall be determined upon for the public good, and the handiwork of God, and the purchase which he made at a great price, shall not be destroyed for trivial offences. 3. We forbid the all-too-prevalent practice of selling Christian people out of the country, and especially of conveying them into heathen lands, but care shall be zealously taken that the souls that Christ bought with his life be not destroyed. 4. And we enjoin that the purification of the land in every part shall be diligently undertaken, and that evil deeds shall everywhere be put an end to. The code goes on to specify how the land is to be purified. Wizards, sorcerers, murderers and prostitutes are to be driven from the land, unless they repent. Likewise, apostates are to be driven out, or else make amends. Thieves and robbers are to be made an end of, unless they desist. Heathen practices, for example, witchcraft, worship of idols and heathen gods, sun, moon, fire, trees, etc., are forbidden. Perjurers and adulterers are to make amends or depart from the land, along with hypocrites, liars, and robbers who incur the wrath of God. Again, there are laws requiring the reform and improvement of the coinage. False weights and measures are to be corrected diligently, and thought shall be diligently taken in every way how best to determine what is advisable for the public good, and how best to promote true Christianity, and diligently suppress every injustice. Many other laws show the influence of Christianity also, including laws dealing with incest, adultery, payment of ecclesiastical dues, rape, bigamy, robbery, excommunicated persons, etc. The code ends with the following words: Now, I earnestly entreat all men and command them, in the name of God, to submit in their inmost hearts to their Lord, and often and frequently consider what they ought to do and what they ought to forgo. 1. There is great need for us all to love God and to follow God's law and zealously to obey our spiritual teachers. 1a. For it is their duty to lead us forth to the judgments where God shall judge each man according to the works which he has wrought. 2. And blessed is the shepherd who then may gladly lead his flock into the kingdom of God and the joy of heaven because of the works which they have wrought. 2a. And well it is for the flock which follows the shepherd, who delivers them from the devils and wins them for God. 3. Let us all then, with humble heart, be zealous in pleasing our Lord aright, and henceforth, by doing what is right, always zealously guard ourselves from the hot fire which surges in hell. 4. And likewise teachers and spiritual messengers shall do what is right, and for the well-being of all men, they shall frequently inculcate spiritual duties. 4a. And everyone who has discernment shall earnestly give heed to them, and everyone, for his own well-being, shall keep fast in his mind their spiritual instruction. 4b. And every man, for the honour of his Lord, shall always gladly do his utmost by word and by work, and by deed for the furtherance of what is good. Then shall God be the more ready to help us. 5. May the name of God be eternally blessed, and to him be praise and glory and honour for ever and ever. Amen. 6. God Almighty have mercy upon us all, as his will may be. Amen. It is quite clear that during the Anglo-Saxon period, the influence of Christianity in general was strong, and that biblical concepts of justice, morality and mercy were being integrated into the law codes and treaties of kings. Although the law codes contain much customary law, surviving from pagan times in traditional forms, they were increasingly subjected to a strong Christianizing influence. We must now note another aspect of the influence that Christianity had on Anglo-Saxon society, which was of the utmost importance for the development of English law. Christianity has a moral ethic which is individualistic. Each person stands before God on the basis of his own conduct. On the moral responsibility that he bears for his actions as an individual does not materially affect the family, tribe or group to which he belongs. Liability before the law is individual, not corporate. Fathers shall not be put to death for their sons, nor shall sons be put to death for their fathers. Everyone shall be put to death for his own sins. Deuteronomy 24:16. In contrast, Anglo-Saxon society was much less individualistic in this sense, and more importance was placed upon the family group. As a result, the individualistic sense of morality was not a predominant feature of Anglo-Saxon society, and the group was subject to legal liability. Under the influence of Christianity, all this changed. Responsibility slowly shifted from the group as a whole to the person who committed the act, and the church, and eventually the law, judged the act on the basis of the individual's moral responsibility. The influence of the Christian religion on Anglo-Saxon law and society, and its significance for the development of Western law, was therefore of the greatest importance. Of the Anglo-Saxon period, Harold Berman writes, "Christianity broke the fiction of the immutability of the folk law. Gradually, between the 6th and the 11th centuries, Germanic law, with its overwhelming biases of sex, class, race and age, was affected by the Christian doctrine of the fundamental equality of all persons before God. Woman and man, slave and free, poor and rich, child and adult. These beliefs had an ameliorating effect on the position of women and slaves, and on the protection of the poor and helpless. Also, Christianity had an important effect on judicial proofs by oaths, since the swearing of oaths began to take Christian forms and was supported by ecclesiastical sanctions. Oaths were administered by priests in churches, at altars, on relics, and through appeals to divine sanctions against falsehood, and false swearing was subject to discipline through ecclesiastical penances. Indeed, oaths took a place alongside ordeals as a principal mode of trial. The church added the risk of offending God by perjury, and the duty, if one did perjure himself, to confess the sin to his priest and be subjected to penitential discipline. Moreover, not only the false swearing of oaths, but also all other obstructions of justice were considered to be sins subject to penitential discipline. For example, persistence in blood fruit after a reasonable offer of satisfaction was an offence against God, which was to be confessed to a priest and atoned for by fasting and other forms of penance. Christianity also had political consequences, since it served to transform the ruler from a chief, dux, into a king, rex. The king became the head of an empire, unifying the various tribes under his leadership and defeating the heathen invaders in the name of Christ. This was so in Europe with Charlemagne, and also in England with Alfred. Berman writes that Christianity also enhanced the role of kingship in the development of the folk law during the period prior to the late 11th century, and especially the king's responsibility to see that tribal justice was tempered with mercy, and that the poor and helpless were protected against the rich and powerful. In the 8th, 9th, 10th and 11th centuries, Frankish and Anglo-Saxon kings were considered to be appointed by God to act as judges in extraordinary cases. As they moved about their realms, they heard cases for mercy's sake, cases of widows or orphans, or men who had no families to protect them, or no lords, cases of the very worst crimes for which no money payment could make satisfaction. This was part of their spiritual jurisdictions as patriarchs of their people. According to Harold Berman, Germanic folklore does not fit into any model or archetype of customary law because of the influence that Christianity exerted upon it. As Christianity spread, it challenged the ultimate sanctity of custom and of kinship, lordship and kingship relations, as well as the sanctity of nature, exhibited, for example, in trial by ordeal. Christianity did not deny their sanctity altogether, however. Indeed, writes Berman, the church actually supported the sacral institutions and values of the folk, including the ordeals. It challenged their ultimate sanctity, however, by establishing a higher realm of God's law and life eternal. The result was that life was split into the two realms of the eternal and the temporal, the sacred and the secular. Yet, although this split led to the depreciating of the temporal realm, Berman claims that it did not otherwise directly affect it. Rather, social life was indirectly affected in important ways. The basic structure of the folklore remained unaltered, but many of its particular features were strongly influenced by Christian beliefs. The influence of Christianity upon Anglo-Saxon society began with the conversion of Ethelbert. Prior to this, Anglo-Saxon law was unwritten, customary law. With the kings converted to the Christian religion, they began, with the advice and counsel of the clergy, to issue law codes that, although drawing largely on custom and tradition and form, evidenced the growing influence of Christian ideals and principles. With the revival of learning under Alfred, this process took a leap forward, and the content of biblical law was set forth to the people as the ideal of true justice to be imitated. With Alfred, there was also an attempt to legislate for the whole kingdom and to impose a degree of uniformity on English law. Although the law codes issued by the Anglo-Saxon kings were not comprehensive, and therefore England was still governed to a large extent by unwritten customary law, the precedent set by Alfred was followed by his successors, including Cnut, 1016 to 1035, whose laws, along with the dooms of Alfred, were the main sources of Old English law for writers after the Norman Conquest. The effect of Christianity on law and customs in England prior to the Norman Conquest was therefore prodigious. It played a leading role in forming and informing the cultural matrix out of which the common law later emerged. It is to the development of that common law system that we shall now turn. The emergence of the common law system. In the Anglo-Saxon period, the Christian kings issued their law codes with the advice and counsel of the witan, consisting of the bishops and other ecclesiastics, eldermen and thanes. And as we have seen, the content of these law codes, as time passed, became increasingly occupied with Christian and church matters. Furthermore, there was not at this time the same degree of separation between church and state characteristic of later periods. The kings acted in council with their bishops and legislated as Christians, convinced of their duty to honour God by establishing justice and protecting the church. They were also aware, since the church was continually reminding them, of the fact that God blesses obedience and judges the disobedience in history, and therefore that their standing before God was of the greatest importance for the stability of their reign, for the peace and prosperity of their kingdom, and for success in war. The Old Testament King David was the great model for them as Christian kings, and the church actively encouraged such analogies with Scripture. No doubt this is why the historian and professor of medieval history, H.R. Loyne, could use the word theocracy of the late Anglo-Saxon period. Kingship was in a very real sense a Christian ministry for the Anglo-Saxon kings. They were, in a sense, officers of the church, indeed, heads of the church. Church and state were one, and, as Loyne writes, the lordship of the king and of Christ lay over the land and the people. Not until the Gregorian reform and investiture struggle, late 11th and 12th centuries, did this begin to change and the church to assert her independence. In the post-Norman conquest period, there was a separation between the church and state, and the law as a discipline or science achieved a status to some extent independent of either. Of course, common law arose out of the administration of justice by royal courts with jurisdiction over the whole country, and canon law was the domain of the church. But, as Berman writes, in the wake of the papal revolution, there emerged a new system of canon law and new secular systems, together with a class of professional lawyers and judges, hierarchies of courts, law schools, law treaties, and a concept of law as an autonomous, integrated, developing body of principle and procedures. Berman is here writing of Europe generally, and of course Roman law did not have the influence in England that it had on the continent. Nonetheless, the general characteristics of his description are applicable to England also. By the early 14th century, the English common law system was independent of the King's Council and had its own judges, records, literature, and professional lawyers. After invading England, William I was keen to make good his claim to be king by lawful right, that is, as the nominated successor of Edward the Confessor, as well as by conquest. He therefore promised that the English laws would remain in force. In fact, the Normans were, writes J.H. Baker, warlike, uncultured, and illiterate. Whether they appreciated or not, they found in England a system of law and government as well developed as anything they had left in Normandy. Certainly they had nothing of refined jurisprudence to transplant. The initial effects of the Norman invasion were rather backwards. They introduced a new racial discrimination, this time between the French and English, a new and rather barbaric form of ordeal, trial by battle, the separation of ecclesiastical courts from the shires and hundreds, the subjection of the forests to an alien and oppressive forest law, protecting the royal hunt, and a brand of military feudalism, which gave seigneurial jurisdiction a new basis. None of this helped produce the common law, rather the reverse. England, however, was a unified nation with a central government, represented by sheriffs who were responsible to the king, and the beginnings of a bureaucracy operating through writs, written instructions from the king. There were, however, significant differences of law and custom between the three main areas of the country corresponding to the old English kingdoms of Wessex, Mercia, and Danelaw. Without a strong centralised bureaucracy, the unification of English law into a system of common law could not have been accomplished, and it has been speculated that without that unified system, Roman law would most likely have triumphed eventually in England, as it did in Europe. The contribution that the Normans made to the emergence of English common law was their ability in government and administration, since they greatly strengthened and developed England's incipient central government. The common law emerged in the 12th century from the efficient and rapid expansion of institutions which existed in an undeveloped state before 1066. Over the two centuries following the Norman conquest, the Norman and Angevin kings took control of the administration of justice throughout England by creating a system of royal courts. The supremacy of the royal courts was achieved largely as a result of transferring the jurisdiction of the local and feudal courts to the king's justices and the royal courts. Gradually, the local courts declined in importance as the common law courts became more popular and more important. This process was further reinforced by the Statute of Gloucester in 1278, which stated that no actions involving less than 40 shillings were to be tried in a royal court, but which was interpreted by the common law judges as meaning that no action involving more than 40 shillings was to be tried in a local court. As a result, the shire and hundred courts declined even further, and the common law courts became the chief courts of the nation. Although, in one sense, the common law was the creation of the royal judges in and after the 12th century, and was the law which they applied uniformly throughout the realm, it would be wrong to think of the common law as in any way a new or alien law transplanted into England by the Normans. It was not. As we have seen, William promised the English that their laws would not be overturned. The Normans did not bring a body of laws with them to impose upon England. Indeed, they had no written law to bring with them. William himself confirmed, with some additions and amendments, the old laws of England current in Edward the Confessor's reign. In order to secure the papal blessing on his expedition, he did, however, promise to separate the ecclesiastical jurisdiction from the shire and hundred courts. The church and lay jurisdictions, which were inextricably bound together under the Anglo-Saxon kings, have remained separate ever since. The common law, however, emerged from a process in which, although many of the old laws and customs of England dating from before 1066 were abandoned, many more were preserved. To these, new precedents and principles were added as the body of law common to the whole realm was built up. The common law that resulted from this process was not simply a mixture of old English law and custom and Norman government and administration. These were, of course, important elements and factors in the emergence of the common law. But the Norman conquest created a new situation in England that had profound effects in English society. Hardly have Normans and Englishmen been brought into contact before Norman barons rebel against their Norman lord, and the divergence between the interests of the king and the interests of the nobles becomes as potent a cause of legal phenomena as any old English or Frankish traditions can be. English common law emerged from a new and changing society and addressed and was shaped to meet the needs of that society. Consequently, although much of the old English law and custom was retained, much was also transformed or became obsolete, since, as Berman writes, in contrast, not only to the earlier Western folk law, but also to Roman law both before and after Justinian, law in the West in the late 11th and 12th centuries and thereafter was conceived to be an organically developing system, an ongoing, growing body of principles and procedures, constructed, like the cathedrals, over generations and centuries. A good indication of the state of English law in the century following the Norman conquest is given us by a number of Norman law books written in the early 12th century. These law books demonstrate the endurance of many old English laws dating from pre-Norman times, the most significant of which were the laws of Alfred and Cnut. They purport to give us the law that was current in the reign of Edward the Confessor, but they state it in a modernised and amended version. This is English law made practicable for life in the Norman period. There are four such books of the Liber Quadripartitus, written between 1113 and 1118. The last two books are lost. The first book is a translation into Latin of the Code of Cnut and Old English Dooms, going back to Alfred. The second book contains the coronation charter of Henry I and other state papers. The Leges Henrique, written sometime before 1118, is a more important document. It contains the coronation oath of Henry I and states the laws of England as they existed in an amended form in the reign of William I and Henry I. The author took much of his material from the laws of Cnut and the older English dooms, and he may have relied on the Liber Quadripartitus. The author also made use of some passages from foreign law codes. The old differences between Wessex, Mercia and Dane law in matters of law and custom still survived at this time, but, write Pollock and Maitland, the author of the Leges Henrique is in some sort the champion of West Saxon, or rather Wessex law. Wessex is, in his opinion, the head of the realm, and in doubtful cases, Wessex law should prevail. The Leges Williame purports to set down the laws of Edward the Confessor's day, which were granted to the people of England by William I. The book is in three parts. The first part contains rules of Old English law as understood in Norman times, with some Norman additions. According to Pollock and Maitland, this harmonises well with the ancient dooms. The second part contains some writings that show the influence of Roman law, and the third part consists of translations of parts of Cnut's laws. The Leges Edwardi Confessoris claims to set down the laws of Edward the Confessor as stated in the fourth year of William I's reign, but its contents describe the reign of William Rufus and, according to Pollock and Maitland, who describe it as a private work of a bad and untrustworthy kind, was probably written late in Henry I's reign. Besides these four books, there are two translations into Latin of Cnut's dooms that borrow from Anglo-Saxon documents that are lost to us. The picture that these Norman law books give us is that of an ancient system struggling to adapt itself to new conditions. the oldhams are virtually the only written law available. Much of the law is embodied in local custom, but the rules differ between those areas corresponding to Old Wessex, Mercia and Danelaw. The law deals mainly with restitution or compensation for crimes, but the criminal tariff has become exceedingly complex and is breaking down under its own weight. This confused situation was resolved eventually by the development of a centralised royal administration of justice under royal courts and royal justices, who evolved out of this jumble of laws a unified body of law applicable across the whole realm. These were therefore three important factors in the emergence of English common law. First, the Old English pre-Norman customs and laws, which were permitted to remain in force, but in fact many of which were either transformed and amended to meet the needs of a changing society, or else became obsolete. Second, the new social conditions created by the Norman presence. And third, the burgeoning centralised administration of royal justice. These three elements created the cultural matrix out of which the common law emerged. The separation of church and lay jurisdictions. Because church and state were, to a great extent, undifferentiated in Anglo-Saxon England, it is relatively easy to trace the influence of Christianity and of the church upon the English kings and their law codes. Ecclesiastical and non-ecclesiastical laws were not the product of separate legislative bodies issuing separate codes. Rather, the king, as head of the nation and of the church, with the advice and counsel of his witan, consisting of bishops and other ecclesiastics, ealdormen and thanes, legislated for both state and church. There was not the same separation between sacred and secular that characterised the period following the Papal Revolution. After the Papal Revolution, however, the church ceased to be a national institution under the headship of its national leader or king. The church throughout Western Europe became an international organisation under the primacy of Rome, with the clergy owing their allegiance to the Pope, who ruled the church like an emperor. At the same time, the jurisdiction of the church became autonomous of the jurisdiction exercised in the royal, communal and feudal courts. The Pope became, in a new sense, the head of the church. The church as an institution became a spiritual empire with its own rules and law, with the clergy, as the officials of that empire, owing their allegiance to their prince, the Pope. The result was that the dichotomy between the sacred or spiritual realm and the secular or temporal realm became much more pronounced. Matters of law relating to the spiritual realm became the domain of canon law, while those relating to the secular realm came under the jurisdiction of the royal courts and of the king. Actions involving the clergy or touching on spiritual matters and crimes that merited spiritual penalties would be brought in the ecclesiastical courts under canon law, whereas actions involving laymen or relating to secular matters would be brought in the royal courts under the jurisdiction of the king. This does not mean, however, that the church and the state were totally separate in legal matters. For example, an offence that was spiritual and in the first instance to be tried under canon law, such as heresy, could lead to the defendant, if found guilty, being transferred to the temporal jurisdiction to be tried and punished by the secular authorities. But the church acquired a legal jurisdiction in matters relating to spiritual things that was autonomous of secular jurisdiction. The church also claimed jurisdiction over temporal matters in certain cases, and indeed, the papacy claimed to be the final court of appeal in all matters, spiritual and temporal. It based its claim to this jurisdiction on Deuteronomy 17, 8-12 and 1 Corinthians 6, 1-3. The secular authorities also attempted to encroach upon the jurisdiction of the church. Consequently, although it was recognised that lay and ecclesiastical courts were distinct and separate legal systems with their own jurisdictions, there was also the inevitable conflict of interests between the two, which often claimed jurisdiction over the same cases. The conflict between Thomas Becket and Henry II was a glaring example of the problem. despite the gains made by the Church as a result of the Papal Revolution, and in England later as a result of the murder of Becket and Henry's renunciation of the offending articles in the Constitutions of Clarendon, the state slowly wrested much of the Church's jurisdiction from the ecclesiastical courts in the centuries that followed. The Church's influence on life and society was not diminished, however. The investiture struggle led to increased power and authority for the Church in many ways. The influence of the Church on secular law was less direct, but real nonetheless. Influences which helped to shape and inform canon law also passed into secular law. Indeed, the term common law itself was originally used by the canonists to denote the general and ordinary law of the universal church, in contrast to the particular rules of local churches, and eventually the term passed into secular law. Other elements, including some elements of Roman law as refashioned by the canonists, also passed into secular law. The influence of the Church on the developing common law system was significant, if less direct, than the Church's influence on secular law in the Anglo-Saxon period. And Christian principles, although often heavily overlaid with the errors of Roman Catholic dogma, continued to influence the development of secular legal thought. We shall now attempt to trace out some of these Christian influences. Christian influences on the common law. The emergence of the English common law system occurred in an age and in a culture steeped in Christian theology, Christian morals, and a Christian understanding of the meaning and value of life. The influence of the Christian worldview was determinative for social institutions as well as individual lives. Men were born into the church, married at the church, and buried by the church. They lived under the pervasive influence of Christian ideals and institutions, from the cradle to the grave. To be excommunicate was not only to be outside the church, but outside society also. Ideas of justice, morality, right and wrong were naturally conceived in terms of Christian beliefs and informed by the content of Christian revelation, the Bible, as expounded by the church. Hence, as Berman argues, the basic institutions, concepts and values of Western legal systems have their sources in religious rituals, liturgies and doctrines of the 11th and 12th centuries, reflecting new attitudes towards death, sin, punishment, forgiveness and salvation, as well as new assumptions concerning the relationship of the divine to the human and of faith to reason. So pervasive was the influence of Christianity upon the development of Western legal thought, Berman calls Western legal science a secular theology, which to our largely unbelieving society today often makes no sense because its theological presuppositions are no longer accepted. The validity of our legal system rests on religious presuppositions that dominated the age in which it was formed, and therefore it is those religious presuppositions that give meaning to our law and to our understanding of justice. The attitudes and assumptions that inform our legal system are Christian, and our legal institutions and values cannot be understood properly apart from Christianity. Furthermore, in the medieval period, morality and the law were not so sharply distinguished as they are today, and since Christianity was the universal religion in England, it was declared that any law is, or of right ought to be, according to the law of God. And even after case law came to dominate the common law system during the 17th and 18th centuries, and the authority of precedent was generally accepted, the doctrine of precedent was still subject to the reservations of reason and the law of God. According to Berman, the influence of Christian doctrines upon the development of Western legal science proceeded by means of a process in which the legal metaphors and analogies of the 11th and 12th centuries became the legal concepts of the 13th century. Since these legal metaphors and analogies were taken mainly from the Christian theology of the West, the legal concepts of the 13th century embodied the theology of Western Christendom in the period beginning with the Papal Revolution. Berman lists five doctrines that he considers to have had a formative influence on Western conceptions of justice and the development of Western legal science. the Last Judgment and Purgatory, the sacraments of penance and the Eucharist, and, most important of all, Anselm's doctrine of the Atonement. Berman argues that the Christian doctrine of the Last Judgment acquired a new significance during the 11th century that was reflected in the creation of a new holy day, All Souls' Day. All Souls' Day was a day to celebrate the community of all souls who had ever lived or would live, who were visualized as trembling before the judge on the last day of history. The liturgy of All Souls' Day, along with the doctrine of purgatory, writes Berman, provided an important link between theology and jurisprudence in Western Christendom. Sin acquired a new legal definition in terms of specific acts that were considered wrong and that must be paid for by temporal suffering, in contrast with the older view, which saw sin more in terms of separation from God. The kinds and degrees of punishment applicable to those guilty of these sinful acts were to be established, first, by divine law revealed in the Bible, and secondly, by natural law revealed in the hearts and minds of men. These punishments were to be further defined by church law, which was itself to be tested by divine law. The doctrine of purgatory, which began to receive greater emphasis during this period, served to accentuate this tariff of punishments for specific sins. This, in turn, led to a reinterpretation of penance, which, in the process, acquired a strong sacramental character as punishment for sinful acts, in contrast to the earlier understanding of penitential works as a means of reconciliation with God, the Church, and the offended party. Most significant of all in this period, however, according to Berman, was the legal implications of Anselm's doctrine of the Atonement. It was Anselm's doctrine of the Atonement that laid the foundations for the new jurisprudence. Despite its deficiencies, Anselm's doctrine of atonement represented the most satisfactory treatment of the atonement that had appeared up to that time. It was this theory, writes Berman, that first gave Western theology its distinctive character and its distinctive connection with Western jurisprudence. The significance of Anselm's doctrine for the developing legal thought of the time lay in the teaching that God cannot forgive man's sin without satisfaction being made for that sin, and that without much satisfaction, man must be punished accordingly. Christ made satisfactions for man's sin, but that satisfaction was not understood by Anselm in terms of punishment for crime, Christ being the substitute, but rather in terms of penance in the older sense, that is, in the sense of works of contrition, leading to reconciliation of the victim with the offender. Although Anselm's doctrine was an advance and pointed in the right direction, it fell a long way short of the penal substitution theory that emerged in the Reformation. However, Berman argues that Anselm's view of the atonement ultimately depended on another premise which was not fully articulated, namely that a punishment, and not only a penitential satisfaction, was required by divine justice, not for man's original sin, but for personal sins, actual sins, committed by baptized Christians. The implication was that, although Christ had made satisfaction for man's original sin, liability for the actual sins of Christians remained and must be borne by the individual sinner, but that these actual sins could be expiated by the sinner himself through punishments in this life and suffering in purgatory. From a biblical perspective, this theory fails on two counts. First of all, the least of sins is a transgression against the authority of the whole moral law, and therefore, to sin at one point, no matter how venial this sin may be judged by men, is to incur the full condemnation of the law, to become guilty of all, as we are told in Scripture. James 2:10. Accordingly, man cannot by his own suffering or works make expiation for the least of his actual sins, though he must of course repent, that is, turn away from his sin as opposed to doing penance for it, a very different matter. Secondly, except in matters of rebellion against legitimate authority and capital offences, the Bible is concerned primarily not with punishment of the offender, but rather with restitution of order and compensation for the victim. In this sense, the Bible is nearer the older view common in the Anglo-Saxon period, when crime was not conceived as an offence against a political order or society generally, but rather against the victim and his kin, who must be compensated by the offender if he is to escape their wrath. The change in emphasis after the Papal Revolution reflected the growth of centralised political states in which crime is conceived primarily as being committed against the political order, a breach of the king's peace, or against society generally. In this respect, the growth of the centralised political state was a backward step, and yet it was the emergence of that kind of political system that created the conditions necessary for the development of English common law. However, this is not to say that the concept of compensation was lost. Indeed, the almost universal remedy at common law is the award of damages to the injured party. The common law, therefore, maintained a strong element of continuity with Old English law going back to pre-Norman times. But there was a shift of emphasis, as Berman writes. The new concepts of sin and punishment based on the doctrine of the atonement were not justified in Germanic terms of reconciliation as an alternative to vengeance, or in Platonic terms of deterrence and rehabilitation, or in Old Testament terms of the covenant between God and Israel. Though elements of all three of these theories were present, the main justification given by Anselm and his successors in Western theology was the concept of justice itself. Justice required that every sin, crime, be paid for by temporal suffering, that the suffering, the penalty, be appropriate to the sinful act, and that it vindicate, avenge, the particular law that was violated. As St. Thomas Aquinas said almost 2 centuries after Anselm's time, both criminal and civil offences require payment of compensation to the victim, but since crime, in contrast to tort, is a defiance of the law itself, punishment, and not merely reparation, must be imposed as the price for the violation of the law. This retribution theory of justice passed into Western legal theory. It was based on the premise that a tribute, that is, a price, must be paid to vindicate the law. The new doctrine of atonement had other implications also. It led to an emphasis on the immoral nature of crime, since the criminal was a sinner, but since all men shared a common sinful nature, this in turn mitigated the element of moral superiority associated with retributive theories of justice. Also, the belief in the moral equality of all the participants in legal proceedings provided a foundation for scientific investigation of the state of mind of the accused. Finally, writes Berman, the doctrine of the atonement gave a universal significance to human justice by linking the penalty imposed by a court for violation of a law to the nature and destiny of man, his search for salvation, his moral freedom, and his mission to create on earth a society that would reflect the divine will. Christianity also influenced the development of secular law via canon law, which exerted an influence over both the legal theory and procedure of secular law. The laws of the Church during the first millennium of its history, writes Berman, bore the strong influence of the Bible, especially the Old Testament. From the Bible, the Church derived the authority of the Ten Commandments and of many other moral principles formulated as divine commands. Beyond that, the Bible transmitted a pervasive belief in a universal order governed by the God who was both supreme legislator and supreme judge. As heir to the tradition of Israel, the Church took seriously the numinous character of law, its pervasiveness in the divine order of creation. Moreover, many specific rules of conduct contained in the Old and New Testaments, as well as many biblical examples and metaphors, were carried over into ecclesiastical canons. The laws of the Church also bore the influence of Roman law and Germanic folk law, but these were reinterpreted in terms of the Christian religion and moulded according to biblical ideals. For instance, while the Church initially accepted the Germanic tradition of trial by ordeal, the clergy, who often officiated over the trials and performed religious rituals connected with them, were inclined to arrange the results so as to conform to what they believed justice required. For example, in Trial by Hot Iron, in which a hot iron was placed in the defendant's hand for a short while, then the hand bandaged up and inspected a few days later. If there was no blistering, he was innocent. The priests often heated their iron only moderately so that no blistering would be likely to occur. This conformed with the biblical principle involved in the only trial by ordeal known in the Bible, the case of a wife being accused by her husband of unfaithfulness without any evidence, Numbers 5:11-31, which required that God intervene miraculously to prove the defendant's guilt, not her innocence. Eventually, the Fourth Lateran Council, 1215, forbade priests to officiate at or perform religious rituals in connection with ordeals, and this effectively brought the practice to an end. In this way, even primitive Germanic customs such as trial by ordeal were subjected by the Church to the overriding influence of biblical principles. After the Papal Revolution, canon law became much more systematized. Furthermore, the Pope began to assert the right to create new laws to meet the needs of the time. This led to a summarizing and periodizing of the law into old and new law, and their integration into a unified system. This meant also that the law was a developing body of rules, not a fossilized, rigid code. These interrelated elements, 1, the periodization into old law and new law, 2, the summarization and integration of the two as a unified structure, and 3, the conception of the whole body of law as moving forward in time in an ongoing process, are defining features of the Western legal tradition. Canon law, therefore, was the first modern Western legal system, and as such, it provided at many points a model for the developing secular legal systems of the West. Another example of the way the Church transformed existing Germanic judicial proceedings so that they reflected Christian principles was the oath. Oath swearing, or compurgation, was a pre-Christian element in Germanic law. In the older Germanic tradition, the defendant swore an oath to his innocence, and other oath helpers, who functioned something like character witnesses, also swore oaths in his innocence. These oaths were long formulas that had to be repeated exactly without any deviation by those using them. The efficacy of this procedure lay entirely in the ability of those swearing to perform the ritual correctly. If they failed, this testified to the defendant's guilt. If they succeeded, it showed his innocence. Oath swearing, in this sense, was used by the defendant to purge himself of the charges against him. The canonists, however, developed the judicial procedure whereby the judge interrogated the parties in a case in accordance with principles of reason and conscience in order to establish the truth. In the ecclesiastical courts, the parties involved and the witnesses swore an oath in advance that they would answer the questions put to them truthfully. The oath, therefore, acquired its modern sense first in the ecclesiastical courts. The ecclesiastical courts further introduced the modern idea of representation, in which the parties involved in an action were represented by professional legal counsel who argued their cases for them. Again, this development, writes Berman, was closely linked to theological concepts. According to Berman, this emphasis on judicial investigation was associated not only with a more rational procedure for eliciting proof, but also with the development of concepts of probable truth and of principles of relevancy and materiality. Rules were elaborated to prevent the introduction of superfluous evidence, matters already ascertained, impertinent evidence, matters having no effect on the case, obscure and uncertain evidence, matters from which no clear inference can be drawn, excessively general evidence, matters from which obscurity arises, and evidence contrary to nature, matters which it is impossible to believe. All this contrasted sharply with the older Germanic judicial proceedings. Reason and conscience were used to overturn formalism and magic. The influence of the Church and of canon law, and through these the influence of the Bible on the development of English common law, was therefore significant. The justices of the English royal courts in the 12th and 13th centuries were clergymen. Not until the late 13th and 14th centuries do professional lay judges begin to appear. It was the clerical judges who transformed the mass of ancient laws and customs into the common law system. When the clergy were no longer permitted by canon law to sit as judges in the royal courts, the creative age of our medieval law is over, write Pollock and Maitland. English law, more especially the English law of civil procedure, was rationalised under the influence of the canon law. In short, common law was Christian law. It is important that we recognise, therefore, that it was not the nature of the English people, but its public inspiration at its conversion that gave rise to the common law, which could therefore contain, as it really does contain, elements of Hebrew, Roman, and ecclesiastical law. English common law was, to use the words of Eugen Rosenstock Huse, the dowry of Christian baptism. Christianity and biblical law also exerted a significant influence via canon law upon equity. It was stated that equity applied only where the law is directly in itself against the law of God or the law of reason. Equity was administered in the Court of Chancery, and the chancellors, being mainly ecclesiastics, derived the principles of equity from the canonists. In 1489, the chancellor, Cardinal Morton, said, "Every law should be in accordance with the law of God, and I know well that an executor who fraudulently misapplied the goods and does not make restitution will be damned in hell, and to remedy this is in accordance with conscience, as I understand it." As A.K.R. Caralfly explains, the chancellors tended naturally to derive their ideas from the conceptions of the canonists. These conceptions depended upon the theory that the law of God governed the universe, and hence his law and the law of nature and reason, which were nearly synonymous, predominated over the rules of any state. A human law could not be valid in contradiction to divine law. In The Doctor and Student, these two propositions are clearly stated. When the law eternal or the will of God is known to his creatures reasonable by the light of natural understanding or by the light of natural reason, that is called the law of reason. And when it is showed of heavenly revelation, then it is called the law of God. And when it is showed upon him by order of a prince or of any other secondary governor that have power to set law upon his subjects, then it is called the law of man, though originally it be made of God. For if any law made of men bind any person to anything that is against the said laws, the law of reason or the law of God, it is no law, but a corruption and a manifest error. Consequently, the chancellor arrogated to himself the right to interfere with the course of the law in a particular instance, even where the general rule was just, if according to conscience it would work against the law of God. Clearly, God's law and Christian conceptions of justice played an important part in shaping and informing not only our common law, but our whole system of justice. As an aside to our main point, it is worth noting here that the Church also provided a model for Western Christendom in another sense during the medieval period. The papacy was the first modern state. At the top of the hierarchy was the Pope. Although there were certain limitations on his power, the Pope ruled as the supreme legislator and judge over the Church, that is, he ruled as a prince. The bishops also were princes in their own diocese and had power to rule as supreme legislators and judges over their sees, subject only to the intervention of the Pope, to whom they swore an oath of allegiance. The emerging secular states of Europe reflected this type of government in their own administrations. The secular state mirrored the papacy. It is interesting to note also that, after the Reformation, when a new form of church government emerged that was based on different and more biblical principles of government, the secular states of Protestant Europe began to mirror the new form of government in their own administrations. Modern Western political theories of representative government were taken from the Reformed churches and applied to secular governments. This raises an important point. It seems that the Church has often functioned as a model that the secular authorities have imitated. Protestant Europe owes its representative form of government to the Reformation, just as medieval states mirrored in important ways the papacy in their forms of government and administration of law. The model that the Church provides for society at large is important, theologically, morally, and constitutionally, and administratively. When the Church fails in providing this model, the secular authorities will take their role models from elsewhere. Today, we are seeing where the Church's failure to provide such a model of leadership has left us. Secular humanism, rather than the teaching of the Church, is the ideology to which our leaders look to inform their programs and their blueprints for society. Conclusion. It has been said that no proper estimate has been made of the effects of Christianity on English law, but there is no shadow of doubt that it was far-reaching. Our legal system was formed and developed over centuries under the dominating influence of the Christian religion. The ideals and standards of justice that informed our law were derived largely either from the Bible directly or from ancient pre-Christian institutions that have been so completely transformed under the influence of the Church that the original pre-Christian practices from which they originate are no longer discernible in the Christianized forms in which we know them. Our very concepts of justice, due process, and the rule of law are Christian ideals that we should never have known had the Christian faith not taken root in the land and transformed the nation from a pagan into a Christian society. The Christian worldview has dominated the life and institutions of our nation for well over a millennium. Our civilization owes its existence and its health to the vision that the Christian faith brought to the people of this nation. Our justice system, and Western justice generally, is distinguishable from the inhumane and barbarous regimes that have existed and continue to exist in the world today outside the influence of Christian culture, only because it is, or at least it was in origin, a Christian vision of justice. One need only think of the fatwas issued by Muslim ayatollahs inciting the faithful to kill and destroy the property of the enemies of the faith without trial or any due process of law to see the difference. Justice, if indeed it can be called such, is indistinguishable from vengeance against one's enemies for the zealots of Muhammad, since Allah is not a law-giving God, a God of order, but a capricious God, who may one day decree one thing and the next day the opposite. By contrast, the Christian God is a law-giving God who does not change. His justice or righteousness is a permanent standard that does not change and upon which men can rely for certainty and authority. As a consequence, justice, as people in the West understand the term today, has emerged only among those nations and cultures influenced by a Christian worldview. Indeed, the use of the word justice itself here presupposes the Christian faith. Outside of cultures either directly or indirectly influenced by the Bible, we can speak of law, decree, but hardly of what we understand by the word justice, since our conception of justice itself is drenched in Christian meaning. Yet, so many in our culture today take the Christian ideals of justice for granted and never stop to consider what kind of justice we should have. Had the Christian faith not provided the vision and guidance that it did for our nation for so long? As a result, our politicians and church leaders idly stand by as our nation is stripped of the Christian ideals upon which it was built. Pluralism is the new god of our society and the fetish of our modern secular humanist state. But those who worship this idol fail to realise that the various modern contenders for a place in the new pluralist society are nowhere near as tolerant as our own much vaunted liberal culture. And that to give way to this drive for pluralism is to open the floodgates to alien influences that will transform our culture completely. The creation of a pluralist society means the creation, eventually, of different laws for different groups and cultures within our nation. And indeed, this is already happening with regard to some cultural groups. But, even then, it must be understood that a pluralist society is not an end in itself, but simply a transitional phase, the crossing point of disparate cultures, in which the various contenders struggle for supremacy until one finally is victorious and proceeds to impose its culture and its law upon the rest of society. In that transformation, our ideas of justice, based so firmly on Christian ideals, will be swept away, and our nation will enter a new dark age. The descent into such a dark age has already begun. Christian law is today being replaced by secular humanistic law that does not recognize God or his law, nor the fundamental principles of justice set forth by that law, which have governed our lawmaking and the development of our legal institutions for well over a millennium. Principles and concepts of justice that were once held to be inviolable are being overturned every day. Abortion on demand, funded by state revenues, raised by taxation, for example, contravenes not one, but many principles of justice upon which our society and our legal institutions were built. To deny this new legal right to a woman is deemed to contravene her human right to do with her own body, since the child is not recognised as an independent human life as she wishes, a concept that our law had not hitherto recognised, being based upon Christian principles that stress human responsibility, obligation and accountability, rather than rights. One can think of many other examples. The decay of our civilization is at an advanced stage. That decay covers every part of our society. It affects our law just as much as anything else. As a result, so much of what was once considered justice has been overturned, abrogated, or simply ignored. The traditional Christian concepts of justice that shaped our legal system are today becoming obsolete. Parliament passes more and more legislation that takes no account of the values upon which our society was founded, upon which it drew for its health and vitality for so long, and our courts are beginning to reflect the new atheistic ideologies that are shaping our modern society in their interpretation of the law. Today, the innocent suffer at the hands of the guilty, and there are no remedies at law for the crimes that are perpetrated against them. When the law is invoked, it very often only penalises the victim further, either directly or indirectly. The law-abiding people of our nation are beginning to groan under the weight of the injustice they receive at the hands of those responsible for providing justice. Our political establishment, which was traditionally dedicated to maintaining law and order, has done nothing to ameliorate this situation. Quite the reverse, it has passed legislation that leaves the innocent victim even more powerless to defend himself legally against violent crime and without remedy at law against those who commit it. Furthermore, the creation of a socialistic welfare state has also been a substantial cause of the decline of common law, since it has been implemented by means of parliamentary legislation that, due to its very nature, is based on philosophical presuppositions that are fundamentally alien to the Christian religion, which guided the formation of our legal tradition. It is particularly disturbing that this has been accomplished at the expense of judicial independence, one of the very pillars of our Christian legal heritage. E.C.S. Wade stated the problem clearly as early as 1938. It is still accepted constitutional doctrine that the ministers of the Crown do not tamper with the administration of justice. But Parliament, indirectly, has reduced the sphere of influence of judicial independence by the character of modern legislation. The abandonment of the principle of laissez-faire has altered the nature of much of our law. A system of law, which, like the common law, is based on the protection of individual rights, is not readily comparable with legislation, which has for its object the welfare of the public, or a large section of it, as a whole. The common law rests upon an individualistic conception of society and lacks the means of enforcing public rights as such. The socialisation of the activities of the people has meant restriction of individual rights by the conferment of powers of a novel character upon governmental organs. Hence, our society is being transformed by legislation passed in Parliament from a society ruled by law to a society ruled by Parliament, that is, from a free society to an increasingly totalitarian society. Our law is in decline as a system of justice, and yet our society today is swamped with more legislation than ever before. More laws, rules, are passed by our Parliament continually. Yet, justice is increasingly being suffocated by such legislation. Justice requires more than rules. Our understanding of justice, and therefore our law, was based traditionally on a religious ethic that derived its validity from the Bible, from the Decalogue. The decline of traditional Western understanding of justice and law in our society has taken place because the religious presuppositions upon which our law was based have been abandoned by the people of our nation, and in particular by our leaders, both political and ecclesiastical, who bear greater responsibility. Only by a restoration of those religious presuppositions, namely the Christian worldview, upon which our law for so long rested and relied for its moral authority, will our society be delivered from its present hapless plight and our legal institutions saved from becoming the mere tools of political pragmatists, governed by an ethic that amounts to little more than self-interest. Of course, our government is bound to act under law. But today, this is a mere formality, since it no longer recognises a higher law to which all human law and state legislation must conform if it is to be valid law, rather than the mere whim of a dictator, be that dictator a man calling himself a king, or a committee of men calling themselves by the lofty title of Parliament, or Her Majesty's Government. Without the belief that any law is, or of right, ought to be according to the law of God, which formerly guided our lawmaking, the idea of the rule of law is meaningless, since government can repeal any law to which it no longer wishes to conform, and make new laws that it would prefer to abide by. The rule of law, Christian law, is being replaced by the rule of politicians, who will modify or repeal any law, or even overturn fundamental principles of justice, if it is in their own interests, or in the interests of a large enough lobbying group to do so. In short, we are in transition from a society based on the rule of law, in which the government also must act under law that is consistent with the basic religious presuppositions upon which our legal system was formed, to a society in which the law is no longer developing in terms of its basic religious presuppositions, but rather in which it is being systematically overturned and replaced by our legislators with rules based on alien presuppositions. This is happening because the religious presuppositions that underpinned our law and gave it stability and continuity for so long have been abandoned, because the principle of a higher law to which all human law must submit is no longer understood or believed. In this respect, our law is becoming lawless, since it no longer recognises, as once it did, that no law is just or binding if it contravenes reason, as understood in terms of the Christian faith, or the law of God. For over a millennium, the Christian faith influenced and helped to shape our law, and our law underpinned our Christian heritage. Both have now been broken, and our nation faces ruin as a result. The prognosis is not a propitious one. There is, however, a remedy for this malady. Our legislators must recognise once more, as they did in times past when our legal tradition was in its formative period, that any law is, or of right ought to be, according to the law of God.